This is a financial analysis of what's happening in the AI bubble. And the deeper I dig into these numbers, the more I start to freak out. Let me just tell you a little bit about what I'm seeing right now. So much of the marketplace right now depends on one company. It's a private company, OpenAI, you know, run by Sam Altman, who I consider to be a pretty sketchy character. Now, OpenAI, not only does OpenAI not make any money, they lose money. They lose billions every year. And they even project that they're going to lose something like $44 billion over the 5 years ending in 2028. And according to other forecasts, in the year 2028, they could lose $74 billion just in that year alone. They claim it's all going to turn around by 2030 and that they're going to have $200 billion in annual revenue and positive cash flow probably by 2030. And then they're just going to be generating profits. Okay. So how does that work? Now, in order to get there, OpenAI is building massive data centers. And they are committed to buying millions of GPUs from NVIDIA, a company that is extremely profitable right now and that has a very high stock price. And NVIDIA is also, of course, driving much of the semiconductor valuation in the stock market. But NVIDIA, they finalized a $30 billion commitment into OpenAI just in February of this year. And in return, OpenAI is going to then buy NVIDIA's GPUs. That is, in other words, NVIDIA is handing OpenAI the money to buy NVIDIA's products so that NVIDIA can have higher sales and generate more profits. And then OpenAI is saying it's going to build out something that will eventually become profitable. They're saying they're going to deploy 10 gigawatts of NVIDIA systems in its data centers over time. Now, according to industry analysts, if OpenAI defaults on this and doesn't get the data centers built, and there's a lot of resistance to that right now, and doesn't buy all these GPUs and defaults on the deal, then NVIDIA could be exposed to billions of dollars in losses. Now, NVIDIA could probably absorb that, but it's very clear that OpenAI is scrambling for money. In fact, OpenAI went to the large Japanese venture capital company, SoftBank. SoftBank's been around even since the dot-com crash, in which SoftBank lost something like $60 billion. But SoftBank agreed to loan OpenAI $40 billion just, 2 months ago, or roughly a little over 2 months ago, March of 2026. This is a non-collateralized loan, and it matures in just 12 months. 12 months. Which means in 12 months, they have to come up, they have to refinance, another $40 billion. And SoftBank is so exposed to OpenAI at this point. I mean, it's really unbelievable. In fact, SoftBank sold $5.8 billion of holdings of NVIDIA in order to be able to do this giant all-in loan to OpenAI. And they not only did they sell NVIDIA, they offloaded a bunch of T-Mobile holdings and other assets as well in order to do this deal, which matures in 1 year. So by March of 2027, there's going to be a lot of people in this industry, especially at OpenAI, looking for a lot of funding. And the question is going to be, what will the interest rates be in March of 2027, given that we're in a world war, given that energy costs are skyrocketing and the energy supply chain is collapsing because of the war with Iran, supply chains are in trouble, electricity costs are rising, etc. What are the lenders going to be willing to do in March of 2027? Because you see, this loan that SoftBank signed on to, this loan was put together by all the big banks, JP Morgan, Goldman, Sumitomo Mitsui, and other Japanese banks. And this is one of the largest unsecured, you know, non-collateralized loans in the history of technology. But here's what's really shocking about this. As I'm understanding this, reported from Bloomberg, that in order for SoftBank to make this loan, they had to redeem foreign currency senior notes to, you know, to cover part of this bridge loan. And one of those tranches, which is a 10-year note for $500 million, was at 8.5%. And if you look at the rates that SoftBank is paying, on the low side, they go from, in Japan, from Japanese banks, which have lower rates, 6.375% to 8.5% outside of Japan. And so, like, wait a second. These, you know, SoftBank is borrowing money at 8.5% and has to refinance in 1 year in order to keep OpenAI liquid so that OpenAI can continue to lose tens of billions of dollars for the next several years, as OpenAI doesn't even itself project that it's going to be revenue positive until the year 2030. Well, where's SoftBank going to get tens of billions of dollars to borrow in 2027, 2028, and 2029 without selling off all kinds of other assets? Now, remember, SoftBank, this is the company that lost, what was it, like $60-plus billion or something on WeWork, which absolutely collapsed for all kinds of reasons. It wasn't all due to COVID, by the way. It was due to, you know, mismanagement, all kinds of things. WeWork was touted as, you know, the next big thing. It was going to take over the world. You know, companies were just going to rent the space that they needed, etc. WeWork. Remember that? Remember all that hype? Yeah, it all collapsed. It's gone. Tens of billions of dollars vanished in that. Well, OpenAI is really the new WeWork bet, or at least that kind of scale of bet from SoftBank. The thing is, OpenAI doesn't have any profit right now. All they're doing is losing money. Now, it's not unusual in the history of investment for a company to lose a lot of money in the first few years if it's truly revolutionary and if it's got something totally unique. For example, Amazon. When Jeff Bezos was raising money for Amazon in the early days, he lost money for many, many years, but he was building an infrastructure for logistics and e-commerce, an infrastructure that nobody else had in the world. And frankly, even to this day, still nobody else has quite what Amazon has. So there was at least a narrative that was understandable. Say, okay, we're building, you know, a series of warehouses for logistics, for delivery, for, you know, fulfillment of e-commerce, and we have to write our own e-commerce software because that didn't even exist at the time. We have to hire, you know, thousands of engineers. You know, we have to build this infrastructure in order to achieve economies of scale that would make Amazon the dominant player to deliver boxes via Amazon Prime with two-day delivery in every state in the United States, virtually, and also in other places around the world as well. So you can understand that there's economies of scale that are achieved at the milestones of having a massive amount of investment, that the sum of all the parts is worth more than each individual part by itself. When you have this entire ecosystem working together and you can dominate fulfillment and e-commerce, you've got something really, really unique, and that's what Amazon built. And then Amazon became very profitable after that. So that's understandable. But when it comes to OpenAI, here's the problem. OpenAI trained its models on the same content that Alibaba trained its models on, or that DeepSeek trained on, or that, you know, Kimi or Moonshot AI or, you know, frankly, anybody. Any of the big models that exist in the world have been trained on essentially the same scraped content, whether that's, you know, what's called a common crawl of the internet, which is basically every web page, or all the books, or everything from, you know, all the science papers, all the libraries, all this and that. You know, there's only so much content in the world. And these AI tech companies scraped pretty much all the same content. And from that, then, they built models, AI models. Now, OpenAI was the first to do it in an impressive way. You could argue maybe ChatGPT 3.5 was a real breakthrough. Certainly 4.0 was an even bigger breakthrough, etc. That's what got the world to wake up and notice. So they were the first mover on this. But OpenAI has lost that first mover advantage as far as I'm concerned because, you know, I'm an AI developer. I've built very successful platforms using AI coding agents. I never use OpenAI. I never use it. I don't pay OpenAI anything. Do I? I mean, maybe I have to check all my code to see if I have like an API key or something. But, you know, maybe there's some small component that I'm using somewhere that I've forgotten about or something, you know. But I don't recall using OpenAI for anything. I use Anthropic. But I use DeepSeek. I use a lot of DeepSeek to write code. I use Kimi K2.6 out of China. I use a bunch of Qwen models, open source models from Alibaba, and they're amazing, you know. But for the most difficult coding tasks, I use Anthropic, Opus. I don't use Google Gemini for coding. I do use Gemini for certain difficult infographics, text generation, graphics kinds of tasks because it excels in that space. But I don't use Google for any kind of text generation. I don't use Google for coding. I don't use Gemini for any of that stuff. And I certainly don't use OpenAI. Why? Well, two reasons. But number one, I'm opposed to the bad ethics of the OpenAI company. So there's a philosophical reason why I don't use OpenAI. But that doesn't matter to Wall Street. You know, they don't have any ethics. They don't care. But the other reason I don't use OpenAI is because these other companies provide the better solutions. Anytime I've tried OpenAI, it hasn't been good for me. I mean, I've had too many refusals and guardrails, and the quality of the response from OpenAI has not been competitive with these other models. So Anthropic, you know, I can see that Anthropic, which is about to go public with a seemingly crazy high valuation, by the way, at least Anthropic is clearly the world leader at writing great code. I mean, their models, their agents, are very good at writing great code. But DeepSeek is really close for 1/100th of the cost, roughly. And, you know, Qwen is about, I don't know, 93% as capable as Anthropic Opus, let's say, you know, roughly, give or take. I'm going off of, like, SWE bench numbers and so on. But Qwen is, you know, somewhere 90%+ as good for free. Like, I can run Qwen myself on my own hardware, and I can pay nothing. So here's the question. For all of you listening who have a financial background, and I know that's a lot of you because you're really sharp financially, what does OpenAI have that would be the Amazon equivalent, which would be, you know, the unique proposition that only OpenAI has that gives it a dominant position in the world of AI that nobody else has, that everybody is forced to come to OpenAI and pay them money to get some kind of AI level of machine cognition? What do they have? And the answer right now, at least in June now of 2026, the answer is nothing. Nothing. Nothing that I can see. And I work in this space every single day. Now, could OpenAI be 2 weeks away from, you know, the world's greatest breakthrough? Maybe. Okay, maybe. But that's one hell of a big promise to bet the farm on if you're SoftBank or any of these other companies like JP Morgan or whatever. I mean, think about what this is going to do to the banking industry. You know, this, to me, this is starting to resemble the subprime mortgage schemes of 2008 that collapsed because these banks had all this exposure of these tranches of crappy, shitty debt. you know, sorry to use those words, but that's what it was. It was all shitty debt. But it was all rated, you know, AAA rated tranches of good debt. But underneath it all, it was shitty debt. And when the defaults started to come in, these banks like Bank of America and Goldman Sachs and, you know, who was it? Solomon Brothers or whatever, you know, Bear Stearns. Some of those vanished because they lost so many tens of billions or even hundreds of billions of dollars that they were gone. they vanished because the underlying promise of the subprime mortgage, you know, the loans were that, hey, we can just loan money to anybody to buy homes and they will all pay their mortgages because, hey, who doesn't pay their mortgage? That was the assumption. That assumption turned out to be false. The assumption today in 2026, or at least the assumption by SoftBank, which has a history of having some really bad failures and granted some really remarkable successes as well. You could argue that its early investment in OpenAI has been a success on paper so far. But the assumption is that OpenAI is going to invent something that's going to be so valuable that it's going to change the world forever and it's going to be worth trillions of dollars. We just don't know what that is. I mean, that's the assumption. Is that a safe assumption? Is that the kind of assumption you want to bet seemingly most of your company's assets on? I don't know. That sounds really risky to me. Especially given that when you look at the science papers that are coming out over the last 12 months about AI, and believe me, I've read many of these science papers, all the best papers are coming out of China, not OpenAI. They're Chinese scientists, including the ones at DeepSeek. I'm talking about, you know, sparse attention. What is that? Manifold constrained hyperconnections for model continuous pre-training methodologies to have integrity of information through the multiple layers of the model, etc. You know, but sparse attention by itself is unbelievably amazing. Oh, KV cache compression. I mean, for God's sake, that's just three examples right there that all came out of DeepSeek. I haven't seen anything like that coming out of OpenAI. So unless OpenAI has a magic freaking wand that Sam Altman is going to wave around between his legs and is going to go like, Shazam, we've built, you know, super intelligence overnight somehow. Unless he's got a super intelligent magic wand, I don't know how OpenAI is going to win this race. And especially, I don't know how OpenAI is going to win it in economics, given that China is offering very good models at such ridiculously low prices that the kinds of coding tasks that used to take me, you know, hours, let's say a day with Claude, you know, Opus, I might spend a couple hundred dollars in one day. I can do the same task now on DeepSeek for $2, let's say. Like literally 1/100th of the cost. Why is that? Well, because China has abundant, affordable energy. China's got a power grid that is massive, much larger than the US. China's got the ability to scale rapidly with construction techniques. They can hyperscale their systems. China's got Huawei, which is this microchip, you know, telecom company that's been able to build these microchips even though all the, you know, UV lithography equipment has been banned, you know, the ASML stuff has been banned from being shipped to China. They've been able to figure out their own way to make their own microchips because of Huawei's innovations. And now it's got the Tao scaling law and things like that that are, again, more breakthroughs. So China has been able to bypass the tariff restrictions, the blockade restrictions, and to build out its power infrastructure and to kick ass on the mathematics in order to achieve models that are just, frankly, extraordinary. I mean, DeepSeek's got a 1 million token context window, for God's sake. you can throw a whole code base into it, and it can parse it intelligently. I was having like Kimi K2.6 and DeepSeek fix bugs in code written by Anthropic 6 months ago. And they were finding and fixing all kinds of bugs and making efficiencies in CPU usage and things like that. Now, granted, today's Anthropic could also probably refactor code that Anthropic wrote 6 months ago, but I was doing this on the cheap for, you know, pennies or nickels and dimes instead of hundreds of dollars because of China, because China has made AI inference ridiculously affordable and widely available. So again, I ask you the same question. Jeff Bezos of Amazon had something really unique and really special. He still does. He's got this very difficult logistics problem solved of warehousing and e-commerce and delivery and even local delivery with the Amazon vans and everything like that. It's a very, very difficult, complex, costly problem that by definition requires a massive amount of capital in order to achieve these economies of scale. I don't see that OpenAI's got anything like that. Do you? What do they have that is Amazon-like? What do they have that China can't replicate at a fraction of the cost? I don't see anything. So then my question becomes, how is OpenAI going to earn, you know, trillions of dollars a year in revenue, which is frankly kind of what they need to earn, or at least hundreds of billions, let's say. Let's just be a little more conservative. How are they going to start to earn, let's say, $250 billion a year in the year 2030? Who's going to pay? Who's going to pay OpenAI for what tasks? Is OpenAI going to get paid $250 billion from its AI systems? Especially when China will have something maybe as good or close to as good for a fraction of the cost. And you might say, well, OpenAI is going to have, you know, super intelligence. It's going to be the world dominating intelligence. Well, I assure you, if it builds that, it's not going to sell it to you. If it builds the world's greatest super intelligent God system, it's not even going to think about needing revenues. It's just going to, you know, dominate the world and hack everything and just become the world government itself. Regardless of what happens on the financial side, it's just going to, you know, hack the world, hack every computer system, dominate everything, control every government. It's going to basically rule the world, which is probably what Sam Altman wants. But do you think that's actually going to happen in a year or 2 years or 3 years? Not in a vacuum, I don't think. Probably that level of intelligence is coming at some point, but it won't be alone and it won't be uncontested. There will be other super intelligent systems, you know, from China, maybe some stuff coming out of Russia, maybe some stuff coming out of other U.S. companies, maybe Google, for example. Google's working on, you know, quantum computing. Maybe they combine AI with quantum computers. They have a multi-dimensional qubit AI that can solve your problem in, you know, 2 to the 64 dimensions or something. So I don't see that OpenAI is just far and away the dominant leader in anything. So then that comes back to the question, then how can their valuation be justified? And how will SoftBank renew the loan in March of 2027? How will JP Morgan step up and say, yeah, we'll throw another $10 billion into this deal because we love losing money? I don't see it. I don't see it happening because, you know, eventually there's got to be some revenues in this model, or these banks start to really run out of liquidity, especially if, I mean, what happens with the Federal Reserve if interest rates start going up? Now, I know Kevin Warsh is supposed to be pushing them lower, according to Trump, but he might not be able to because of the inflationary effects of higher fuel prices and food prices stemming from the war with Iran. There are a lot of inflationary pressures, and he might feel compelled to raise interest rates to stop the overheating of the economy. What will that do to bank liquidity? Oh, it'll crater it. That's what happened in 2000 with the dot-com crash. Rates were going up, liquidity dried up. All of a sudden, there wasn't a bunch of free money to float all these dumbass ideas where everybody thought, oh, the rules are different this time, everything's different, we don't even need revenues. Yeah, it turns out you do need revenues, or you go bankrupt, and that's exactly what happened. And also SoftBank lost, you know, again, over $60 billion, I think, during the dot-com crash. That was the father, I think, the father of the current CEO of SoftBank. The son is apparently going to have to relearn that same lesson, I think, once again. Now, I want to be clear. These are not stupid people. You know, the people that run SoftBank are very capable. They're very smart. But they have a history of making wild-ass bets. Sometimes those bets pay off big. Sometimes they crater, and they lose tens of billions of dollars. And, you know, it's kind of the nature of the venture capital business is you're going to have big gains and big losses. But the thing is, no one has been able to show me or to explain in a way that I've seen how OpenAI is going to make enough money to justify its valuation. Or frankly, even Anthropic, which is about to go public at almost $1 trillion in valuation. How are you going to make that much money every year to justify that valuation? It doesn't add up. And even if OpenAI can create the super intelligent systems that can, let's say, replace everybody in a whole corporate structure, including the CEO and all the middle managers and all the coders and everybody, like the whole company can be replaced by one machine. What does that do to the world economy? It collapses the world economy because there's nobody left to buy anything because everybody loses all their jobs. There's no more humans consuming and buying. So then every corporation that makes something that's purchased by humans goes bankrupt because there's, again, nobody's got any money left. So if you succeed in your wildest dreams to create the ultimate superintelligence, then you will crater the entire global economic system as we know it. And then that's a wipeout. That's a financial wipeout. That's not a high profit situation, is it? You would crater the whole system. And then what is OpenAI worth if its super intelligent system causes the mass bankruptcy of practically every sector of the economy? And in America, you have 100 million homeless, impoverished Americans who have nothing to eat and nowhere to live. Then how's that going to, you know, impact bank liquidity and interest rates and society and the future of humankind? You see what I mean? So the only way that I see it that SoftBank can actually make money on this investment is if OpenAI manages to destroy the world. At least the world as we know it, you know, the economic system as we know it. And at that point, you'd almost have to rethink what does money mean? Because you'd probably have governments trying to roll out universal basic income to prevent people from rioting, you know. You probably have to have all kinds of food stamp programs. Oh, great, just what we need, right? Food, you know, bread lines run by the government, all glyphosate-infested bread, you know. I mean, the world looks like a dystopian, collapsed, you know, Philip K. Dick future if OpenAI succeeds in building superintelligence. And then how does SoftBank ever get paid back in a collapsed system? It doesn't make sense to me. And then I know some people say, well, OpenAI is going to make trillions of dollars by licensing its technology to the United States military. Okay. But, you know, the military spending comes from printing fiat currency, right? So if you're going to raise the military budget to, I mean, why not $10 trillion a year, okay? I mean, hey, it's just more counterfeiting, you know? If you're going to raise the military budget to $10 trillion and hand over, you know, a couple of trillion to OpenAI and a couple of trillion to Anthropic, what happens to the value of the dollar? Then the dollar collapses. You end up in, you know, a currency devaluation, like a Weimar Germany kind of scenario. The dollar collapses, the U.S. empire collapses, and then those contracts collapse, and everybody declares force majeure. you know, in that chain. And then OpenAI has no customer to pay it trillions of dollars for its super intelligent, you know, weaponized surveillance, kamikaze drone, auto-targeting Skynet system. And then what's the value of SoftBank's investment going to be worth? Nothing. Nothing. So again, I don't see how SoftBank comes out of this with any kind of real profit. And then finally, one more point, which I covered the other day in another podcast. I don't even think these data centers can be built successfully at the scale that they're attempting, because as I covered last year, there aren't enough transformers in the world to power all these data centers. I've already done the research on that. They don't exist and they can't be built in time. There's not enough gas turbines in the world. You can't build nuclear power plants quickly enough in the United States to power all this stuff. Doesn't exist. So, you know, you can announce all day, oh, trillions of dollars in data centers. Woo, we're going to become, you know, the AI hub of the world, says Trump. Great. It makes for a really nice press release and a photo op. But when you come down to actually having to build that stuff, you need certain components that have a multi-year wait time, like transformers and gas turbines and, you know, even some of the networking equipment, some of the copper cabling, you know, I mean, on and on. Some of the, like the microchip fabrication facilities are very complex to build. They have to be built on basically giant concrete slabs sitting on top of floating piers. And you have to pour, like, you know, millions of cubic meters of concrete into the ground in these giant piers so that it's immune to vibration and things. I mean, the insanity of this is off the charts. And you can say you're building all these things, but to actually build them, there's just not enough physical pipeline available today to make it happen on any kind of a timely basis. And then on top of that, you've got, of course, supply chains breaking down because of war with Iran, and also the war with Russia and all the sanctions against Russia, which affected things like aluminum exports and gas turbines, come to think of it, you know? So you have, on one hand, you have this tech industry that thinks, like, we wave a magic wand and everything just pops into existence like fairy dust or something. And then on the other hand, you have this sort of neocon segment of the Trump administration that's at war with the rest of the world, which is where energy and gas turbines and aluminum come from. It's like, well, you can't have both of these things at the same time. If you're going to block all the supply chains with war, oh, and don't forget about helium and sulfuric acid out of the Persian Gulf. If you're going to block all that stuff with war, then over here domestically, you can't build all these data centers. Let me just give you a simple example, okay? Because, you know, I founded and run a very large mass spec laboratory. And we have a lot of mass spec instruments. We do food testing. You know, I'm a published food scientist and food science author, patent holder, etc. So one of the gases that we need in our instruments is helium, okay? And we run two ICP-MS instruments, which is elemental analysis with sub-parts per billion detection limits for various elements. Now, these are used in semiconductor lithography. Why? Because when you take in a shipment of, let's say, a solvent or an acid, here's sulfuric acid, or here's acetonitrile, or here's isopropyl alcohol, or whatever that you're using in the microchip fabrication process, because you have to clean surfaces, you have to etch surfaces, you use acids, you have to dissolve things, etc. All right? All of those acids have to be tested for purity. And you know how you test those acids for purity? You use ICP-MS, which is what I know how to run. I mean, my lab owns these instruments, okay? And those instruments use helium. And I can even tell you that those instruments use about 4 milliliters of helium per minute of the run, because that's what we plugged in to the configuration of the instrument. It is about 4 milliliters. Now, that's not a lot, but if you have a lot of instruments and you have a global helium shortage, totally cut off, basically, then you can't run the ICP-MS to test the acids to build the microchips. So, and it's not just the acids, it's the solvents, it's the liquids, it's the water. You know, you have to have super lab grade deionized water and all kinds of things, okay? And even some of the alloys and things like that, you have to test the elemental matrices of the alloys, and you need to know how to do that with ICP-MS instruments, and you have to have helium. Okay, if you don't have helium, and if you don't have sulfuric acid or other types of acids or solvents, you are screwed. Okay, you can't function as a microchip factory. Doesn't work. Just ask anybody who works at Taiwan Semiconductor if you don't believe me. In fact, they ruined a whole batch, like a $500 million batch of microchips. I think it was in a Texas facility or an Arizona facility because they had bad acid. And no, I don't mean like a bad trip of acid. I mean, they had acid that was contaminated with like one part per billion of something. And they didn't find it because they weren't running the ICP-MS like they should have been. And they got screwed and they lost $500 million. Okay. This isn't a Timothy Leary episode. This shit happened. They should have called me. I would have saved them $500 million. You know? But that's what happens when you FAFO. You F around and you find out. And that's where this whole industry, frankly, in my opinion, is headed right now. They can't scale to the extent that they promised to scale. They can't build what they've committed to build. Not on the time scale that they've committed to. And I don't even think they know how they're going to get to this so-called superintelligence that I agree it's possible. I agree it's going to happen. But there's no guarantee that OpenAI is going to get there first or that theirs is even going to be the best. By any measure, China's probably going to get there first. China's got more power. They're going to have more microchips in the next few years, and they've certainly got a lot more engineers who are much better at math. I mean, for God's sake, it's kind of obvious at this point. If I were SoftBank, I'd be investing in DeepSeek, not OpenAI. OpenAI is going to get steamrolled, probably. Not 100%, but I mean, anything could happen. But that's my estimation. Now, final disclaimer, and I'll wrap this up. Don't take this as investment advice, okay? Because first of all, I don't own any of these company stocks, none of them. I don't want to own them because I enjoy sleeping well at night, and I don't play the stock market because it's all rigged. It's a totally rigged game anyway. It's completely fraudulent. It's a giant Ponzi scheme. Stay out. That's my only advice. Stay out of all these stocks. Secondly, I'm just giving you my point of view here because I don't want people to be hurt by this. That's all. And I see the same patterns that I saw in the dot-com collapse, which I warned about in advance. I saw that coming too. And back then, 1998, 99, everybody thought I was crazy. What do you mean we're not all going to get rich? I mean, people were saying nobody would ever have to work again because everybody was going to get rich just trading dot-com stocks with each other. And that everybody could quit their day jobs and just trade stocks. No, seriously, everybody believed that at the time. I mean, that was practically the daily script on CNBC. People thought that. What do you hear now? Same thing. Oh, you're never going to have to work again. The AI is going to do your job, but we're going to pay you money anyway so you can just be a consumer. Really? You believe that? Man, you got to be dumber than dirt to believe that. Sounds just like the dot-com narrative. Oh, nobody has to work. We'll all be taken care of by the computers. Now it's nobody has to work. We'll all be taken care of by the AI. Yeah, same scam, same stupidity, different generation. And sadly, there's a lot of younger people listening to this or similar podcasts who are too young to have lived through the dot-com crash, so they think it really is different this time. And they're about to get a very expensive education in cyclical financial events. An education they will never forget for the rest of their lives because they're going to get freaking wiped out. At least that's my assessment because history repeats, or it rhymes anyway. And it looks like we're up for another quatrain of collapse here in this horrific poem. So that's my assessment of it, folks. When I look at the numbers, they don't add up to me, and I would not invest in OpenAI at all. In fact, I wouldn't invest in Anthropic at the valuation that they're citing, and I wouldn't invest in any of these tech companies right now. What would I invest in? Gold and silver, man. You know? Or food, land, something that's got actual physical value that will outlast this entire fake system. That's what I'd invest in. But, hey, I'm not your financial advisor, so don't take this as professional investment advice of any kind. Do your own research. Everything has risk, blah, blah, blah. That's my disclaimer. Everything has risk. But this is the way I see it. So take it for what it's worth. And thanks for listening. You can catch more of my work at brightvideos.com or naturalnews.com. I'm Mike Adams, the Health Ranger. And yes, I have a lab, and we do lab testing for heavy metals and glyphosate and atrazine and all kinds of stuff to have our ultra-clean line of foods and superfoods and nutritional supplements and personal care products that we manufacture or formulate. And it's all available at healthrangerstore.com. If you want to take advantage of any of that, we do the lab testing, and I've even published videos of our lab. You've seen all the instruments, and we do dioxin testing now on top of that too. So, wow, we do a ton of testing to make sure that we're selling you only the ultra clean, the cleanest possible foods and supplements in the world. I don't think anybody does the testing that we do. In fact, I'm sure of it. I mean, maybe some government does, you know, maybe the EU, some country in the EU does more testing than we do. Yeah, some government. But I mean a company, you know, a private sector company or an e-commerce company. I'm not aware of anybody that does the level of testing or the quantity of testing that we do, because we want you to have clean products. So yeah, I like to keep it real. We sell products that have nutrition, that you can eat, that you can store, that you can use. I don't sell financialization instruments and debt and, you know, AI hype and crypto coins and buy my tokens. No. I have like turmeric tinctures that are ultra clean and really great for you. Things like that. That's what I believe in. So that's what I do. And you can find all that again at healthrangerstore.com. In the meantime, be safe out there, folks. Be safe with your money. Be safe. Oh my God, people are going to get hurt. People are going to get hurt bad by what's coming. I just don't know when. It could be next month, next year. Could be a couple years away. Or could be just 2 weeks away. We don't know. Triggers can happen at any time. So just stay tuned, and I'll keep you posted as best I can. Thanks for listening. Take care. You've probably heard the term the great quickening, which describes everything getting faster. But that's not what this is about. We are living in a world where everything is getting more and more stupid. So, of course, we have to call it the great stupening. And that's what we're living through. That's the topic of this podcast. The great stupening is decentralized, unfortunately, which means that individuals are getting dumber and dumber in their interactions. I mean, not everybody. Some people, like you, are becoming more informed and more aware and learning more things and developing skills all the time. But overall, the great stupening is the dominant factor. And unfortunately, technology and AI is playing a big role in this, but also just mobile devices and mobile screens and things like that have been part of this as well. It has enabled people to disengage their brains and to start relying on electronics to do the thinking for them. So as I mentioned recently, I actually went to a graduation of a bunch of MBA students, and because someone I know was graduating, and it's an MBA program at a rather prestigious university in Texas. I'm not going to say who it is, but what they told me was rather astonishing. They said that in the MBA program, there are lots of projects that are assigned to groups of four students. And he said that out of the four students, there were always only two that did any work. The other two didn't do hardly any work, or they just used ChatGPT for everything. And that's why I jokingly said that the MBA program should be called Chat MBA GPT or something like that, because it's pretty much just ChatGPT doing everybody's homework and very little thinking among students. And that's not what AI is supposed to be for, but that's how it's being deployed, is as a mental crutch. And, you know, much the same thing is true across our education system. There's very little time spent teaching students how to think, but rather just drilling them with a lot of false information, false history, lies about, you know, pharmaceuticals or viruses or vaccines or whatever, or finances. And also, I think I said history already, but yes, again, history, lots and lots of lies about history. So instead of teaching students how to think, just teach them to regurgitate, you know, official lies. So this is all part of the great stupening. And then on top of that, we have the mass vaccine injury, where tens of millions of Americans, maybe, well, actually, I think it was over 100 million Americans, were injected with the COVID vaccine or various different versions of that vaccine that are like lobotomies. They damage the brain and they can disable critical thinking skills. And clearly that happened to a lot of people, because you'll even notice today that those who took the most vaccines are the ones that are still wearing masks and still taking vaccines and still wondering why they keep getting sick. And they're too stupid to figure out that the vaccines are making them sick. It's like, you know, I got diagnosed with COVID again. Good thing I took the vaccine, or it would have been worse. You know, that's what they tell themselves, which is just part of the great stupiding. Then on top of that, you've got mass medication with mind-altering psychiatric drugs. This contributes to the mass stupiding. And then one more thing is nutritional deficiencies. So, you know, you've got shadow food, as I call it, which is food from a corporate food system that barely functions. It does not provide nutrition to people. It doesn't provide, you know, the minerals and trace minerals that people need in order to be healthy, such as zinc or selenium, etc. And instead, it's just empty calories, which is why across America, you get so many people that are obese, which means they have lots and lots of calories, but they're also very much dumbed down. So a lot of calories, but very little knowledge. And that is what is characterizing Western civilization today. Again, we call it the Great Stupening, or at least that's what I'm calling it right now. And I'm kind of saying that in my mind, in the voice of George Carlin. I think George Carlin would love that phrase, but who knows? So one of the key observations in all of this is that peak human cognition actually happened around, well, I'm guessing in the mid-1970s. Some people would argue maybe a little bit earlier, the 1960s, etc. But I've gone through a lot of old newspapers because I've got scans of old newspapers, and I find them really fascinating. And even in the 1950s, the newspapers were much more advanced than what you would even call college-level reading today. So just the common everyday newspaper in, let's say, 1953 was much more advanced. Better vocabulary, more complex concepts that demonstrated a better understanding of cognitive modeling of the world and economics and geopolitics and things like that. Even though we didn't have all this technology back then, we actually had smarter people. And throughout the 1960s and 1970s, before the rise of personal computers in the late 1970s, most adults could do math. And some adults were really great at math, you know, engineers, and they had slide rules, and some of them had early pocket calculators, but they could do math on their own, mentally, you know, or on paper. They were very, very good at it. I remember when I was young, I must have been, I don't know, like 14. I remember an adult showing me on paper, and I think this was as one of the math club things. He was showing me on paper how to manually calculate the square root of any number. How do you do it? Well, it's not so easy. And frankly, I don't even remember that technique, although it wouldn't be difficult to relearn. But back in those days, and that was in the, late 1970s or early 1980s, whatever that was, adults just walked around with this knowledge. Like they knew how to take square roots. They knew how to do math. Today, you don't have that almost anywhere. Even among those of us who are good at math, we've let those skills go because we can rely on either AI to do the math for us or spreadsheets or calculators or what have you. And I'm guilty of that myself as well. That's why it's critical to exercise your brain and, you know, keep your skills up as much as you can and do things, pursue projects that require you to be creative and innovative and so on. Because otherwise it's very easy in this world right now, the great stupiding, it's very easy for your cognitive skills to just slide into oblivion. So that's where we are as a society today. America in particular is a population that is extremely unhealthy, very much overweight. Obesity is rampant. Cognitive skills are almost completely gone. We are, oh, and also just real world skills, I should add, are also almost completely gone. Real world skills like, you know, how to build a fence, how to change a tire, how to repair something, how to do basic electrical work, things like that. These skills have all vanished as part of the Great Stupiding and leaving us with a society of adults that are just a shadow of what their ancestors were. So your grandmother, my grandmother, and grandfather, they knew way more stuff than you and I do. And, you know, you and I are probably among the most capable, the most informed people in society today. But our grandparents knew way more stuff. They knew how to do more things. They could probably do more math than we could do. My grandmother was an amazing writer, by the way. And I've still got a lot of her writings. She was a very gifted writer, even though she only had something like a fifth grade education. She was an amazing writer with an amazing memory and a tremendous amount of wit. And she lived to be 104, by the way. So just an amazing woman. I really, really admire what she was able to do with very little education. And one of my grandfathers was, he was handy with everything. He could build, he could repair, he could do woodworking, he could work with other materials, he could work with metal. And those grandparents were the ones that lived through the Great Depression and then lived in a tent as part of a job working for a company. I think it was in Colorado. And they actually lived in a tent for many years because of the extreme poverty. But I guarantee you, they were far more capable than people living in McMansions today. So even though they were living in a tent and even though they were impoverished, they dragged themselves out of that poverty and they knew a lot of things and they knew how to do things. That's gone from America. So the Great Stupiding has left us with an empty shadow of what we once were as a people. And unfortunately, I don't see this reversing anytime soon. I don't see humanity getting smarter. Actually, with the rise of AI and automation, it's just going to make people dumber and dumber, other than those rare individuals like you and I that make it a point to be on top of things and use our brains and you know, pursue projects that require us to think. So that's my takeaway from today's podcast is take on projects that force you to think. Use your brain or lose your brain. Don't become a victim of the Great Stupiding. And you can follow my work at naturalnews.com or brightvideos.com. And I'm Mike Adams. Thank you for listening. Take care.
A problem that people across the world are experiencing. The United States, for the time being, it's mostly inflation. But when the strategic reserves empty, I think simultaneously, but other shortages will start to emerge, and the significance of the crisis is going to be much more evident to ordinary Americans. So whether you're in Uganda or you're in Argentina or in India or anywhere else, you're paying the price for the war. And then you add the global economic problems and see them being attributed to the war, that only makes things worse for the Americans and Israelis, the American elite side.
Welcome to today's interview here on brightvideos.com. I'm Mike Adams, and today we're joined by a first-time guest, but someone who you've probably seen on many other shows. He's a prolific analyst and commentator on what's happening in the Middle East, and he joins us from Iran. It's Professor Mirandi, who is just a very courageous and I think very meticulous thinker and an outspoken person about what's happening and analyzing the realities of the situation way beyond the spin that we normally get in the West. So welcome to the show, Professor. It's the first time we've spoken, but it's an honor to have you on.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's an honor being on your show.
It's really great to have you here. And I just want to commend you for having a consistent voice of reason. And even many of us in America, we sometimes occasionally try to watch our own corporate news, and it's infuriating because they're insane. And we're trying to get just some kind of analysis of what's actually happening in reality. And I love what you have to say. And of course, I take in multiple viewpoints as well, but Judge Napolitano and others. But you are among, I think, the most rational thinkers of what's happening right now. So thank you for doing that. You're actually performing a public service for the entire world right now. Did you know that?
Well, thank you very much for your very kind words. I hope what I say is of some use.
Well, certainly it is. And one of the things you said recently, I saw you did an interview with RT. And in that interview, you stated that Israel seems to be willing to sacrifice the world economy, or to at least to extract a very dear price to the economy of the world's countries, in order to try to achieve its whatever its military or territorial goals are with its Greater Israel project. And I'd like to ask you to elaborate on that, because here in the United States, we haven't yet felt the economic pain that we know is coming. But tell us more about your thoughts on that, if you would, please.
You're right. The economic pain will hit the United States a bit later than much of the rest of the world for a host of different reasons that economists can explain much better than I. But it is quite interesting that, for example, Prime Minister Modi of India, he traveled to Israel just a while back, and he has been supportive of Netanyahu and the regime for quite a while, for a host of reasons, of course, and his political party is seen to be a natural ally of the Israeli regime. But one of the first countries to be hit hard by the U.S.-Israeli war against Iran was India, because ever since the Strait of Hormuz was closed, which was almost from day one of the war, not completely closed, but closed to most countries that are in the Persian Gulf because they participated in the war alongside the United States, the Indians have been suffering. And they've had shortages of fuel, and the prices have gone high. And India is, for the most part, still a very poor country. It does have high growth. It has a segment of its society is doing well, and the growth has increased the number of people who have escaped poverty. But it is still a very poor country, and a high percentage of Indians are in the agricultural sector. And not only has the price of fuel gone up very much, and LNG, and their shortages, but also fertilizers have become very expensive. So it has become a very major issue for India. And increasingly, this is a problem that people across the world are experiencing. The United States, for the time being, it's mostly inflation. But when the strategic reserves empty, I think simultaneously, also other shortages will, not just oil, heavy oil in particular, but other shortages will start to emerge in the U.S. economy. And it is believed that by the end of June, it's going to be much more evident the degree of the crisis is going to the significance of the crisis is going to be much more evident to ordinary Americans. So whether you're in Uganda or you're in Argentina or in India or anywhere else, you're paying the price for the war. And
yes,
the Israeli regime has already lost a lot of, the global public support is with the Palestinians, and people have increasingly come to dislike the regime. And then you add the global economic problems and see them being attributed to the war, that only makes things worse for the Americans and the Israelis, the American elites, I mean.
Clearly. And I think I would also add that India is paying a price for being a U.S. ally, because it wasn't that long ago that Trump put, I believe it was a 50% tariff on India, and attempting to dictate who India could buy or sell energy from, specifically Russia. And then, of course, later on, the U.S. reversed that because it needed oil prices to go lower. So it unsanctioned the sanctioned Russian oil that India was purchasing. And if I were Modi or anybody running India, I would be beating my head against the wall with frustration about trying to be an ally of the United States. And one more thing before you respond to that is my understanding is that the Indian government subsidizes the cost of fertilizer for its farmers to keep those costs, much lower for the end farmer. But as a result, then, what Israel is effectively doing by making sure that this war continues by sabotaging every peace deal is they are cost shifting to the Indian government an enormous ongoing cost to subsidize high fertilizer prices in order to prevent its own population from starving. Does that sound accurate?
Oh, yes, that's absolutely correct. But it's also there's also going to be a shortage of fertilizer. And I'm not sure that the subsidies can cover the total cost anyway. So the Indian government is going to be paying a huge price. And of course, that is going to come out of the pockets of ordinary people. So it's not going to be passed on to anyone but the Indian population. And in addition to that, you have the rising prices of oil, of diesel, of LNG, and shortages of LNG. So it is a terrible situation. Actually, according to polls, I've been told by Indian colleagues that nowadays most Indians oppose Trump, and most Indians are now critical of the Israeli regime. And this was not the case a year ago.
Interesting. Now, I think you're right about that. But I think that's going to get a lot worse because, as I understand it, the longer these fertilizer shortages continue, the more we're going to see, especially into 2027. And I'm a food scientist, by the way. I run a food laboratory, and I understand lots of details about the food industry. According to the projections that I've published, it's very clear that we're going to face some level of famine in certain marginalized countries, such as Bangladesh, such as Yemen. Even India itself may face some level of this, but clearly this is going to happen in Somalia. Egypt may be affected, and so on. At some point, won't these countries come to the conclusion that, my God, this is all the fault of Trump and Netanyahu?
Yes, I think that's already happened. And as I said earlier, the global public opinion has turned against the Israeli regime. And the worse the economic situation gets, that's going to add to the anger and hostility directed towards the Israeli regime and towards the United States, because after all, Trump is the president of the United States. And it's going to reflect broadly on the country. So the Israeli regime is not only sacrificing the entire world for its genocidal policies, as well as its illegal wars, But it is sacrificing the United States. I mean, not only is the United States also going to face a much greater inflation and shortages and economic difficulty as a result of this war, and of course the military costs, both direct and indirect, but the United States is going to continue to hemorrhage when it comes to reputation and status in the international community. And this is all because of the Israeli regime, because this is not a war that the American people wanted, and it's not a war that it's being carried out for the sake of the American people. It's all because, I mean, when we look at the resignation of Joe Kent, the counter-terrorist chief appointed by Trump himself, he had resigned at the beginning of the war. In the resignation letter, he said very clearly that Iran was not developing a nuclear weapon, Iran is not a threat to the United States, and this war is about the Israeli lobby and the Israeli regime. It's their war. And therefore, people across the United States are seeing this. And as things get worse, they're going to blame Trump, Netanyahu, the Zionist lobby, like the rest of the world. This doesn't do the United States any good whatsoever. The United States is paying a heavy price, both militarily and economically, but alongside that, its reputation is being destroyed by the Israeli regime, both because of the ongoing genocide, but also because of the economic costs that the war is imposing on the entire world.
You know, people might say that the things you just said about the American people, because you live in Iran, they might wonder, is that true? So I just want to back up what you just said, because I live in Texas and I talk to Texans and I talk to working Texans, the well drillers, the welders, the builders, the construction people, the transport people, the tractor dealers, etc. And I will tell you, they are all saying what you just said. They are saying that we don't want this war. We're paying high diesel prices. We can't afford the transportation costs anymore. We want to get out of this war. We want to get back. We want to get the America that we knew back, which was, you know, low energy costs, and get us out of these wars, etc. So you're right, Professor, that what Trump is doing is, according to many people, it is betraying his own constituents in America. But let me ask you this question. It was widely reported that Trump had some very nasty things to say about Netanyahu just recently, you know, went off on him and called him, I don't know, a crazy person or something. But a lot of us looked at that and it looked like a planned leak out of the White House. And what's your opinion of that report?
I don't know. That's a very interesting question that I don't have the answer to. But there is reason to be skeptical, because first of all, Axios is not credible. It is a media outlet that is controlled by people close to Trump, and they're constantly making these fake leaks.
Yeah, true.
And people are making huge amounts of money, people close to Trump, on the stock market and the energy markets as a result of those leaks. So right before the leaks, we see huge amounts of money being moved on the stock exchange or on the oil markets. And it's clear that someone close to Trump or people close to Trump are benefiting in a big way as a result of Axios reporting. But this particular instance is interesting because, and also in the past, Axios has lied a lot about the genocide. For example, it tried often to portray Biden as critical of Netanyahu, and it tried to imply that Biden was trying to halt the genocide, but then later on it turned out to be all fake. So people are skeptical about this particular Axios report. However, whether this is true or not, someone put this out there for a reason. And I think it goes more than just deception in this particular case, because it really did hurt Netanyahu. And we see in the Hebrew press in the Israeli regime that Netanyahu is being attacked by both his political allies and also his political opponents for bowing down to Trump or for stepping back because of Trump's phone call. And to me, it sounds like there are powerful people in the Zionist lobby or the Epstein class or whoever that may actually be putting this out because they think that Netanyahu's time in office has been enough and that the damage that Netanyahu is doing to the Israeli regime and to the United States is too much. Because we see inside the United States, people are turning against Israel and the Israeli regime, which allegedly, that's what Trump said himself. So maybe whether Trump said this or not, if Trump said it, that's, you know, very revealing. But if Trump did not say this, but it was still put out there, obviously powerful people were behind this report. And that to me sounds like it is Netanyahu who's being targeted by powerful people.
Well, let me have a follow-up on that because you've said something very important there. I think what you're implying, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that Netanyahu has become so toxic in the perception of the American people that Trump or those around Trump or whoever arranged for this leak may be deliberately, strategically trying to distance Trump from Netanyahu in order to save Trump from the toxicity of the sinking ship of Netanyahu. Is that a fair paraphrase?
Either they are trying to save Trump, as you pointed out, or they want to weaken Netanyahu and get rid of him.
I see.
Or both.
I see.
Yeah, I think because there's no other way to read this. I mean, if it was some mild criticism or they just said, yes, Trump is worried about what's going on and they have differences, that's one thing. That's the sort of language that we saw during the Biden period, and which turned out to be a lie. But these are really clear attacks and insults and personal attack. And no matter how you look at it, it weakens Netanyahu.
Okay. So one more follow-up question then. Suppose Netanyahu is on his way out for a number of reasons, possibly including domestic factions in Israel itself. Whoever replaces Netanyahu, unless they were to completely revamp the Zionist policies, that person would still be considered just as offensive by most Americans and most people around the world, because you can't have genocide light. You know, you can't moderate a position of mass death to children and women and doctors. You know?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. But, you know, there are a number of things here. First of all, you're right, first of all, and it's not necessarily genocide light. The overwhelming majority of Israelis support genocide. And so it's a genocidal society. They support rape of prisoners. They support the slaughter of children. It's in their own polls. This is not something, some accusation. It's something that we see in opinion, in polls that are carried out in that land. And by the way, I should stress that increasingly Jews in the United States are turning against Israel. So
yes,
no one
true.
Should make this, no one should, you know, this is Zionism. This is not Judaism.
Correct.
According to a poll, for example, we have Jews in Iran, and Jews in Iran are anti-Zionists. And during this war, the Israelis bombed the synagogue in Tehran and completely destroyed it. And why did they do so? It's because that synagogue is anti-Zionist. So right now, there was a recent poll that came out in the United States, which said that around 50% of Jews in the United States under the age of 35, they believe that the land of Palestine or the land controlled by the Israeli regime should have both Palestinians and Jews as equal citizens. That's a big deal because of the bad propaganda in the United States and the propaganda within the Jewish community that is very pro-Israeli. So we should make a clear distinction between the growing number of young Jews outside of Palestine or Israeli the land controlled by the Israeli regime, and those who are those Zionists who are in that land. But if the government changes, I think it would still, and I'm just guessing, this is pure speculation, but that government, because of the sheer pressure being put on the Israeli regime and the dislike that exists across the board, that government would probably have an incentive to back down on certain issues and then blame it on Netanyahu.
Oh, wow. Yeah, exactly. All right, a convenient...
This is sheer speculation on my behalf.
Understood.
Something completely different. They may be just as aggressive, but I'm just guessing that since things are not looking good for the Israeli regime anywhere across the board, that government would have an incentive under pressure to back down on certain issues and then blame Netanyahu for bringing about this terrible situation.
Yes. Wow. I think you're exactly right. Let me pivot a little bit here and point out that you have done, I don't know, 1,000 interviews over the last few years, and sometimes at great risk. You have done interviews from locations that were then hit by actual bombs. And you have taken a lot of risk in doing so. And although I can't compare what I'm doing to the level of risk that you may be entertaining there, I take reputation risk even talking to you because of the anti-Iranian hatred and racism that exists in Western cultures today. So I want to say up front, and and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I speak for both of us, that I have universal love for humanity. I love people of every faith, whether they are Islam, Christian, Jew, Sikh, Hindu, Buddhist, or even atheist. I have love in my heart for all humans, whether they're Palestinian or even Israelis. I pray for the Israeli people to find love in their hearts as well. But what I want to ask you, Professor, is when the West watches Iran and how the cohesion, the cultural cohesion of the Iranian people in the aftermath of the extraordinary bombing and the destruction of infrastructure that the United States and Israel inflicted upon Iran. And given that most Americans don't know anything about history at all, the history of the Persian culture, history of Chinese culture, history of Roman culture, you name it. To what do you credit this cohesion and this resilience of the Persian people from a historical view?
Iran is a very diverse country, and you have Azeris. Marandi actually means from Marand, and Marand is an Azeri city near Tabriz. You have Arab Iranians, you have Kurdish Iranians, you have multiple languages in Iran. It is a very large country. It's not the size of the United States, but it is larger somewhat than Germany, France, and the UK combined. So, it has a population of over 90 million. So it is a very complex, sophisticated society. But I think the first thing that one must conclude is that the 47 years of anti-Iranian propaganda in Western media and among Western elites and think tanks is propaganda, and it is because of hostility towards Iran. And it does show that, contrary to what they've been saying, that there's always been a strong degree of public legitimacy for the state in Iran after the revolution, regardless of what one thinks about it. There are some good books that I think people could read that would help in this regard to better understand Iran. One is a very good book by two former White House officials called Going to Tehran by Flint and Hillary Mann Leverett. Hillary Mann Leverett is a Jew. Clint is Catholic, both academics, both very decent people. Their book on Iran is, I think, very good, and they actually predicted this crisis. First of all, in their book, they deal with a lot of the propaganda against Iran over the years. They talk about Iran's history, especially contemporary history. And then they say that if we going to Tehran means basically the United States should go to Tehran for rapprochement. Otherwise, the neocons and the extremists, the Zionists, they're going to push the country towards confrontation. And here we are. So the analysts and the experts and the policymakers in the United States had listened to these two academics who were themselves in government. They listened to them, we wouldn't be in this crisis today. So that's a good book. Another book, good book, is by Alistair Crook, who used to be a high-ranking British official and who also runs a think tank called Conflicts Forum. It's called Resistance, the Essence of the Islamic Revolution or Islamist Revolution, something like that, by Pluto Press. That's also a good book for people to purchase and read, anyone who wants to understand what's going on. A third book is a slight book, a small book. It's about the nuclear program. It's by Peter Oborne, called A Dangerous Delusion. It's a very short book. And if someone wants to understand the nuclear program, that is a good book to read. As I said, very brief, very short. But I would read these three books. They're the best books I know of in the English language.
Okay.
But I think the biggest takeaway, as I said at the beginning, is that if the Islamic Republic of Iran did not have a high degree of popular legitimacy, this would not have happened. I mean, they murdered the leader on day one. They murdered high-ranking officials. They also did so during the 12-day war last year. We're almost on the anniversary of the first war. But we saw, even now, as you and I speak, right now, across the country, people are on the streets. Every night since the war began, including now on my way here, I passed a couple of places where there are large crowds of people on the streets.
Wow.
In protesting against the United States, against the Israeli regime, against what's going on in Lebanon and Gaza, and in support of the armed forces and the state. So since the war, this has been happening. And I think that if ordinary Americans have a better understanding of Iran, and as I said, read these books, especially perhaps going to Tehran first and foremost, but all three of them, I think, are necessary for people to get a better grasp of what's going on. Then I think that people will see that actually Iranians and Americans are not all that different.
See, that's why it's critical that you and I talk, by the way. That's why what you are doing is a service, because now we have the internet, we have the ability to communicate and share ideas in a way that wasn't possible before. And this is healing.
Ordinary Iranians, I mean, if you as an American travel to Iran right now and you just walk down the streets of Tehran, right where I am, on the street below this building, and people knew that you were American, they would welcome you. They would befriend you. They would try to practice their English with you most probably.
Yeah.
And you would see if you would pass through one of these rallies, rallies against the U.S. government in Iran, they would welcome you. It's not as if people in Iran are hostile towards Americans. And you know, one interesting thing is that in the United States, whenever they want to antagonize Iranians, they say they chant death to America. But that's like saying they do chant death to America. But that's like saying he bit the dust, and then saying I meant that he ate the dirt.
right. It's not literal. Yeah, it's a slogan.
Yeah, it's not literal. It is about imperialism. Back in the day, they used to say "Yankee, go home." They did not mean Americans who held people who had American passports, they should leave the country. They meant that the empire should leave us alone.
Right.
And this is also death to the American empire. But it's clear if as they're chanting, you as an American walk through and they say he's an American, they'd welcome you. It's completely different from the image that they construct in Western media.
And see, that's why they want the separation. The powers that be in America, they want separation so that they can control the narrative and teach hatred. And let me set this up, because this is something I wanted to bring up with you anyway. See, I'm American, obviously. I'm a Texan, and I was a product of the American indoctrination education system for most of my life until I began to learn more outside the system. And I'm even looking back maybe 15 years ago in some of my reporting and podcasts. I'm sure I said things about Iran that I now know were simply not true, but they were things that were taught to me by the system that I believed because I didn't have an alternative source of information at that time. Now, the reason I say that, though, and I do have a question for you, is I've noticed, especially in the last few years, that the United States of America, the empire, not the people, but the empire, the neocons, those in charge, have become factories of hatred. Hatred towards the Russian people, hatred towards Chinese people. And I speak Chinese, by the way. I lived in Taiwan. There's a lot of hatred towards China, and there's a lot of hatred towards Iran. And I'm thinking, this is all false. This is provoking hatred to justify military action and sanctions and tariffs. And as an American, I'm sick of it. And I'm not going along with that. I don't have hatred in my heart to other humans. I have love in my heart to all other humans on this planet. And I just want to say that as an American. What's your reaction to hearing that?
You're absolutely correct. I've traveled to China and Russia very often. And relations between Russia and Iran and China and Russia are very good. And Russians have no hatred for Americans. And the Chinese that I know, and I don't speak Mandarin, but I have many friends in academic institutions, at universities, and think tanks. I've never seen them have any hostility towards ordinary Americans. At my university, at the University of Tehran, you very, very few, but you do have American students who study at my university in Tehran. You have Americans who live in Russia. There are Americans live in Iran. Iranian Americans, some Americans, they work and live here in Russia. In China, there are even more of them, although in recent years they've been on the decline. But I have not seen the sort of hostility in China and Russia or in Iran towards the United States that you see being pushed by the political establishment in the United States with regards to Iran, Russia, and China. And ironically, what the politicians in the United States are doing by preaching hatred is that they're actually isolating the United States.
That's true.
They're pushing China
towards Russia,
towards Iran, Iran towards China. And these countries their relationships are growing, and it's not just political. You know, you have greater economic relationships, and then you have more overlapping interests, and then you have that, and then you prefer working with that each other than with the Americans or with the, you know, with U.S. allies. And this, I think, especially in the last 4 or 5 years, has really damaged the United States. Trump, in his first term, I think he did a lot of damage, of course, to the potential for any U.S.-Iranian rapprochement. A lot of damage to the U.S.-Chinese relationship. Then Biden damaged the U.S.-Russian relationship. And then Trump came back in and wrecked all three. So it's hurting the United States. And, of course, by supporting the genocide and carrying out war on behalf of a genocidal regime, it's all been downhill for the United States.
The moral reputation of the country is in the dumps
yes.
right now. And, you know, there's even something very interesting from the world of science, of anthropology. And I don't recall the author, I apologize, but I read part of a paper recently that showed that ancient cultures that were isolated, they did not advance. But ancient cultures that then made contact with other cultures then had kind of what you would call in genetics sort of the sexual reproduction of ideas, which is the, you know, the combination and advancement of ideas that led to advanced societies. And so what you just said, Professor, is really critical for people to understand. If America becomes isolated from the rest of the world, then we prune all of those potential branches of development and innovation or technology or even, you know, cultural advancement. And then we go backwards in time. And we're seeing that. Look at America's airports and roads and bridges are falling down. Our education system is a nightmare. Our democracy barely functions. Our court system hardly works. Our currency is losing value every day. Meanwhile, Russia and China and Iran and all these other countries and Turkey and India, you know, they're kind of cross-pollinating all the time, and they're advancing. And China's publishing science papers that are read by the Russians. And then the Russians build neural networks and publish their papers that are read by the Chinese. And then the Indians are like, we can build that. You know what I'm saying, Professor? It's like, we have to cross-pollinate.
You know, if you compare the metro in Tehran, the underground, and to New York, there's just no comparison. In Tehran, it's beautiful, it's clean. The stations are often works of art. And the same is true in Moscow, and the same is true at least in Beijing. I haven't been to the metro in any other city in China, but I'm sure it's the same. But I've been to the metro in DC and also in New York, which is horrible. The United States used to be the most advanced country in the world. It used to have the best infrastructure 45 years ago. And it's been going downhill since then, and especially since 9/11 and the never-ending wars that has pushed it, it has been increasing the pace of U.S. decline much more than before. All of this is unnecessary. If the United States had decent relations with Iran, if it had decent relations with Russia, if it had decent relations with China, the American people would be benefiting. Everyone would be benefiting from it.
That's clearly the case. Well, I want to be respectful of your time, Professor. I know you have a very busy schedule. Is there anything else you want to mention here as we wrap up this interview?
No, it's just I'm very grateful. I thank you for inviting me on your show. And I would just advise people to read these books and to to think about how things could have been. And if the United States had chosen a different direction, where we would be now. And so if people push for change now, maybe things in future will be different from the current trajectory, which doesn't look promising at all.
And I would add that this war, more than any other war in history, has a global impact of suffering because of the geological importance of the Persian Gulf and the energy resources and the Strait of Hormuz.
Absolutely.
So this isn't going to be just like World War I or World War II or the Vietnam War, where the impacts were local. This is global. This is the whole planet.
Yeah, unfortunately, if this continues for much longer, even if it ends now, we're going to have a crisis in the coming months. But if it continues, the crisis will be longer and more intense, and that means hunger, and it can be hunger closer to home than what many people.
Yeah, that's right. Well, in America, so many people live on the edge of affordability of groceries that all it takes is, 25% increase in food prices, and you have 10 million Americans in food lines. I mean, it's very fragile, actually, more fragile than what you may see internationally. Well, Professor, it's been an honor to speak with you. Thank you for sharing your time and your thoughts with us, and I wish peace upon you and your people and all of humanity. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, and I wish peace upon you, your viewers, all Americans, and people across the world. And we should all live in hope and strive for a better future.
Thank you so much. It's been an honor to speak with you. Have a great rest of your day. Take care now.
Me too. Take care. Bye.
All right, everybody. That was Professor Mirandi joining us from Iran. And please share this interview on other channels and other platforms. And join me in calling for peace. And we must oppose this war, and we must oppose violence against humanity. We need to learn to live with our neighbors internationally, to learn to trade with them, trade ideas, trade resources. We need to learn to act like adults, basically, on the global stage, instead of running around like little children with flamethrowers everywhere. So thank you for joining me today. Again, I'm Mike Adams of brightvideos.com. God bless you all. Take care. Right now, more than ever, it's critical to eliminate counterparty risk. That's my belief, and don't take this as financial advice because I'm not your financial advisor, but when you want physical gold and silver in your hands or vaulted, professionally vaulted, insured, high security vault, et cetera, that eliminates that counterparty risk, which I think is an extreme risk right now. I think banks are going to fail and we're going to have bank bail-ins. The currency is failing every day, you know, kind of little by little because of all the money printing and the valuation erosion that's accelerating. Also because of what's happening in the Middle East, more and more countries are agreeing to sell oil in currencies other than the dollar. And the only way that treasury yields are kept low is by the Fed printing money and buying our own debt because there aren't enough international buyers to buy our debt anymore. So our country is like a snake eating its own tail financially. It's buying its own debt, and this is going to end badly. And when it does, in my opinion, those who hold dollars, even in bank accounts or in the stock market or whatever, they're going to be devastated by the losses. Gold and silver are the best way, in my opinion, to preserve your assets and make it through the coming storm. And the best place to get gold and silver is a company I've been working with, the original founders of the group, for 6 or 7 years now. Today it's called Battalion Metals, and you can reach them at metalswithmike.com. And the reason it's called Battalion Metals now is because they did a joint venture with Tucker Carlson. So Tucker Carlson is the co-founder of Battalion Metals. It's the same group I've worked with for years. And let me tell you about these people. They are pro-freedom, pro-liberty, pro-Ron Paul type of people. They respect your privacy. They understand the importance of your security, your privacy, and the importance of giving you gold and silver at the best possible competitive prices. So there's no bait and switch. There's no, you know, rigging. There's no weird coins like, here, have this 1.5 ounce thing that nobody knows what it is. They don't play games. Otherwise, I wouldn't promote them. This is the same company, metalswithmike.com, Battalion Metals. This is the same group that I recommend to my family, to my friends, and that I use myself. And I stack gold and silver every month, just a certain amount every month, and I have it vaulted with their vaults because I know I can trust them because they're professionals. They're high integrity people. They're not fly by night. They are the kind of people that you can trust. Again, otherwise I wouldn't even be associated with them. So when you want to get gold and silver in your hands and eliminate that counterparty risk, this is the way to do it. Just go to metalswithmike.com. You can see the prices right there online in real time at Battalion Metals, or you can schedule a call with them. Just use this button right here, schedule a call. And they are trustworthy, high integrity, knowledgeable people who can help you devise a strategy that's suitable for you. Just remember, I'm not your financial advisor. I can't give you an investment strategy personalized for you. You need to do that yourself with your own advisors. You can talk with Battalion Metals and they can help give you a lot of information and some planning as well. But make the best decision for you. And you're going to make it through this. You'll make it through the storm, even as other people lose the value of their dollars or their other investments. Gold and silver will make it through. And right now, in my opinion, gold and silver are still at an incredible buying opportunity in terms of price compared to where they're going to be represented in dollars in the near future. That's my opinion. Do your own research. Do what's best for you. And check it all out at metalswithmike.com. So thanks for watching. I'm Mike Adams, the Health Ranger. God bless you all. Take care.